All right, is this thing on? I don't know if they can hear me. Can you hear me? Through the microphone? Ah, there we go. Wow. Okay. And if we could just make it a little brighter up here too, that'd be fantastic. Wow, it's really bright. Looks like everybody just disappeared. All right, well, welcome. I know some folks are trickling in, but I want to make sure that we get started on time. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a senior content developer on the Exchange team at Microsoft. Out of curiosity, for how many of you is this your first Mac? Wow. And how many of you have been to more than three Macs? Anybody been to all of the ones in the U.S.? Was anybody else here 18 years ago at the first Mac we had here in 1996? See one over there. See one way back there. Anybody else? One over there. All right, great. Well, welcome, everyone. How many of you have seen one of the tips and tricks sessions before? All right. And how many of you would like me to just walk back and forth and keep asking you questions for the 75 minutes? Wow, that's a surprisingly large number of you. Okay, well, great. Well, if you haven't seen the tips and tricks session before, this is kind of one of those sessions where it might be almost considered potluck, where I'm just bringing in a whole bunch of things that are new and different and interesting. Some of the things are so new, we haven't talked about them yet. Some things are semi-new, you may have heard of them, and I'm gonna fill in maybe a couple gaps or tell you a couple interesting things that you might not know of. And then there's some other content with practical tips and tricks that we have in there as well. All right, so let's start with the basics here. What are we talking about in terms of Exchange 2013? So whenever I do one of these tips and tricks, I like to go through the milestones of what we had. So most of you should be familiar with this. I'm sure all of you know, for example, that we RTM'd back on 10/11/12. And since then, we've had many milestones with Exchange 2013. On-premises general availability, which was when you could first purchase Exchange 2013, and then service general availability, which is when we flipped the switch and moved everybody in Office 365 from the Wave 14 bits to the Wave 15 bits. Then for on-premises folks, since the RTM release, we have had several cumulative updates. We've had CU1, we've had two forms of CU2, that's what the asterisk is there for. We released CU2, found a bug in it that we thought was so bad that we recalled it, and then a few days later we reissued a replacement that had that bug fix in it. So that's CU2, and then CU3 we had back in November. And of course, as Brian said, and as many of you may already know, we also RTM'd Service Pack 1 on February 25th. Out of curiosity, does anybody want to take a guess at the time distance, either in months, years, months, and weeks, or just in days alone, the difference between RTM and SP1? Anybody know off the top of your head? You want to shout it out if you know the answer? How many days? No one wants to guess? Okay, I'll tell you. 502 days. It's 1 year, 4 months, and 2 weeks ago that RTM came out, and about 1 month ago or so that SP1 came out. All right, a note about SP1. Some of you have may run into this. We've worked very, very hard to increase the quality of our releases, particularly since, as I just mentioned, we've stumbled on a couple of them, like the CU2 bug, where we had to actually recall that update. And we like to think that the releases that we have are very stable and very reliable and that all customers should deploy them. And that our testing infrastructure and our methodology and our servicing plan in terms of deploying in the cloud first before we go on premises, we like to think that that works to the advantage of everyone. But then every once in a while, something comes along that sort of messes with that plan. And this is one of those things. We don't test with third-party products, so here's an instance where using a third-party transport agent or a custom homemade transport agent can end up messing with your transport services right after you install SP1. So the good news is it's actually a very easy fix, and it's a fix that you can go and do yourself manually, or you can go to that KB and we've got a fix-it solution where you literally click a button and it will run the script and fix up that problem on your server. Basically, if you ran into this, you know that after deploying SP1, you're not able to start the transport service and that these transport agents don't run. That's been fixed, and again, that's one of those things where we will do and are doing a very serious post-mortem on that to figure out how we can prevent things like this from happening in the future. All right, let's talk about updatable PowerShell help. I wonder, how many of you knew this? How many of you know that when you do get help against an Exchange commandlet, the text that's returned is the exact same text that you would see if you went to the documentation on TechNet for that commandlet? It is literally the same. How many of you knew that? Awesome, that's great. It's a large majority. So what's interesting is, if you didn't know that, there's a screenshot. So here's the get help on a new database availability group. You can see it on the commandlet side. You can see it there on TechNet. It is the same single source. It might look a little different in terms of formatting. We don't have bullets in PowerShell. We've got asterisks, for example. There's some carriage return line feeds missing for brevity and so forth. But otherwise, it is the same single source that's put in both places. Now, one of the challenges that we have with this is it's very easy. If I have a bug in one of my topics, or any of the other writers in Office CPUB have a bug in their topics, we have publishing tools where we can go and make the change, and we can push that topic out to TechNet right away. So any of the commandlet help stuff that needs to be updated, we can get that on TechNet that day. But to get the get help experience in the product, historically, you would have to wait for the cumulative update or the service pack, whichever milestone we're in, because that's where those updates come from in terms of the get help commandlet. Well, now what we have is we have a downloadable PowerShell help. Now, you do have to have an Exchange server that's connected to the internet. We don't have an offline story just yet for this. But if you have an Exchange server that's connected to the internet, you can run the update Exchange help commandlet, and this will go and get the commandlet updates and put them into your get help syntax and basically update the commandlets out of band, and you no longer have to wait for the service packs or cumulative updates to come out. So now we've got a much faster time to not only fix bugs, but this also helps with localized content. So any of the translated versions that we have, we can get updates to both TechNet and both to commandlet help at a much more rapid pace. One other thing I'll point out, though, is that you may see something when you run get help. You may be asked if you actually want to run this update help commandlet. That is different from update Exchange help. The update help commandlet is the standard Windows PowerShell help. So if you run update help, you'll be doing the same thing, but for Windows PowerShell, not for Exchange. So do update help for PowerShell, do update Exchange help for Exchange, and you will always get the latest updates. And the way it works is there's an XML package definition that we look at. So if there is nothing new, then nothing gets updated, nothing gets downloaded, and it's a very quick process for you to go through. It's not something that you have to go through on a regular basis. It's only something where if you happen to notice that some information has changed on TechNet, you can look at the dates of the documentation to tell you when that's happened, and then you can go and get the updated information out of band for PowerShell as well. All right, let's talk about some of the changes in Service Pack 1. I would hope that all of the new features I'm going to talk about, everybody's heard about by now, because I know we've already talked about it in some of the sessions. But just in case you haven't, there are some missing features that weren't in the RTM version of Exchange 2013 that are now in Service Pack 1. They made their way back. Things like the Edge Transport Server, things like Secure MIME in Outlook Web App, things like the ability to do SSL offloading, and Exchange Admin Center command logging. And I'll have a few things to say about these features in a bit. A couple other things that we've done is, hopefully most of you are aware of our support for Windows Server 2012 R2 at this point. That includes both installing on R2 and using R2 directory servers in both R2 domain or forest functional level. So basically full functionality with Windows 2012 R2. We've also introduced the MAPI over HTTP protocol. I know you heard a little bit about that today as well. Just have a few notes on that to sort of round out your information. But in case you haven't heard, that's a new communication protocol that we've introduced in Exchange 2013 SP1 and Outlook 2013 SP1 that is intended to replace our dependency on using RPC at the transport layer for Outlook and Exchange communications. And then the data loss prevention enhancements. I would hope all of you are familiar with that. We did some stuff in the keynote to talk about it, and we've been talking about it in the Garage series and on the blog for a while. We've got some great new features there, including policy tips in OWA, document fingerprinting, which is a fantastic way to add new secure information sets to DLP, and the classification rules and policies for some of the new regions. Some other things that we've done, we have replaced the rich text editor in Outlook web app that we had, the legacy Exchange one. We've replaced that with a new one. I'll talk about that in a bit. We've also enabled and extended the offline access for Outlook web app outside of Internet Explorer. You'll now be able to do that in Firefox. We've also introduced the ability to use apps from the App Store while you're in the Compose experience in email. Okay, so that's not just a benefit for information workers out there, but it's also a benefit for any of you application developers out there as well, because now this is a new scenario in which your apps can get surfaced to end users for use. We've also done some things around hybrid, specifically around allowing organizations that have multiple forests to be able to connect those multi-forests in a hybrid relationship with a single Office 365 tenant. Now, caveat around that, though, we have enabled that, but we're not quite there in terms of our tools and documentation. I'll talk about the tools in a little bit and where we'll go with those. But in terms of the documentation, that's also a little bit behind where we are in terms of the code right now. So if you're looking for the step-by-step process on how to do that, it's not there just yet, but it's coming soon. We've also introduced this ability to create a database availability group without a cluster administrative access point. Some folks have called this an IP address list DAG. Some folks have called this a simplified DAG. Really what it comes down to, it's more of a simplified cluster because we're not really doing too much with the DAG. More so we're changing the way we configure the initial cluster. I'll show you what I mean by that and tell you about some other sessions where we'll talk about that as well. And then there's also a new HA feature called loose truncation that I'll briefly mention and point you to the other session where we'll get into depth in it as well. As you might imagine, with new features comes new commandlets. So as an example, things like the SMIME config commandlet set, those are there so you can configure and view SMIME configuration settings for Outlook web app. Things like the get data classification and the fingerprint commandlet set, those are there supporting the new DLP policies. The search document format, I'll show you examples of that, how you can add new search formats, document types for the Microsoft Search to be able to search and so forth. I'm not going to go through every single new commandlet. Again, all the commandlets that we've added are largely there to support all of the features, so they should be relatively self-explanatory. You will also see, coming in CU5, not a whole slew of commandlets, but a whole bunch of new parameters coming for existing commandlets, particularly some of the managed availability and high availability commandlets. So some of those you're going to want to review when we release CU5. All right, I'm not going to go through this table, but I did want to include it for you. It's just a list of all the fixes in Service Pack 1. These were issues that were reported to us directly either through the TAP program, which we now call the pre-release program, or by our MVPs, or by a customer calling us in for support. In addition to those are the ones that are all published in sort of one roll-up article. But in addition to those, there's also some other miscellaneous fixes that have also been documented in there. These are things that we found internally that we fixed, but documented publicly. But in addition to this, there are a whole bunch of other code changes and fixes and other things that have been done that simply don't warrant a KB or any kind of documentation on them as well. There's literally hundreds and hundreds of check-ins that we've done since the RTM version, between RTM and SP1. So obviously we can't document them all, but I have given you some of the more critical ones on this list for you to look at. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Edge Transport Server and some of the other features that we have. So the Edge Transport Server, if you haven't heard, it's back in SP1. If you haven't heard why, it's back in SP1 really for one specific scenario. Because when we want to do secure mail, particularly from Office 365 to an on-premises administrator, many customers want to have the ability to have an Exchange server running in a perimeter network that is the connecting point for the cloud service. We haven't been able to do that until SP1 because the only other transport role we had in 2013 was the mailbox server itself, and the mailbox server, as you know, is not supported in a perimeter network. So now we've got a perimeter network Exchange server that customers can deploy. This does give them the internet-facing perimeter network secure email server and completes that hybrid solution and some of the other online to on-premises mail flow scenarios that some customers were looking for from us. It's very super easy to set up. Even if you've never set up Edge before, ever. It will take you probably less than 15 minutes to both set it up and configure everything that you need to configure. But a couple things about management though. There's no GUI, there's no Exchange Control Panel. Why is that? Well, the Exchange Control Panel, as you know, runs within IIS. Putting IIS on the box just to have a graphical user interface was not worth it to us, in part because IIS dramatically will increase the attack surface of that perimeter network server just by having those services running on it. So we made the active conscious decision to make this a very secure perimeter SMTP gateway, and as a result, there's no IIS, and because there's no IIS, there's no Exchange Admin Center and no ECP or any other virtual directories. So what that means is all of your management is done with PowerShell. There's about 33 commandlets that you'll be using to manage the Edge Transport server. The good news is if you've been doing any management of mailbox transport or any management of hub transport in previous versions of Exchange, these are the same exact commandlets you're used to using. So if you've done any management of transport, you already know most of this stuff and how to use them and what the parameters mean. All right, some notes. I think Brian mentioned that Edge can work with 2010 and 2007 legacy environments, but there are some updates that those environments need in order to understand and be able to interact with Edge. So if you're running 2007, you need update rollup 13 for SP3. If you're running 2010, you need update rollup 5 for Exchange 2010 SP3. The other thing I'll mention, and some folks have discovered that if you look at the PowerShell module names that we have on the Edge Transport server, you'll notice that they refer to the exchange.management.powershell E2010 namespace that we used internally. This does not mean that all we did was copy and paste the 2010 code, change 10 to 13, and then ship it. That is absolutely not true. It's actually all brand new code, but for backward compatibility and legacy purposes, we kept the same module names. But otherwise, it's all brand new 2013 code, just like the rest of the 2013 code base. All right, SMIME. How many of you are looking forward to using SMIME in Outlook Web App? Like, two hands went up, okay? We worked really hard on that. It's hard. Okay, well, so everybody else can tune out. So for the two of you, I'm just talking to you two now on this. We do support all the encryption algorithms that you'd expect for SMIME. We support multiple signing algorithms. But SMIME is also one of those things that you can only configure with PowerShell. So you'll be using the set SMIME config or the get SMIME config commandlet if you want to view it and so forth. But one thing to keep in mind, you see where we have the encryption algorithms, there's that little four-digit code that's next to each one, like 6602 or 6610 or 660E and so forth. Those codes are important. You're going to want to know those codes because those codes will actually get used in the PowerShell commandlet where you will be choosing the encryption algorithm and the signing algorithm that you're using. So you don't have to type out like AES and 128 or anything like that. You just put in the code, a colon, and then the encryption strength level, as I'll show you in a minute, and it will go ahead and configure it that way for you. These codes are documented in TechNet, but they are not documented inside anywhere but the PowerShell commandlet. So that's the only place you're going to find them. But the good news is, because it's the commandlet file, it's in get help, so you'll have them at your fingertips while you're at the PowerShell console. We also now, one other new thing that we're doing is we are supporting triple wrapped messages. And I don't know about you, but I can't say triple wrapped without thinking of bacon somehow. I don't know why. I think we need to get bacon in these messages. But triple wrapped, so that basically means what we're doing is we're signing the message, and then we encrypt it, and then we sign that encrypted message again. So that's what we mean by triple wrapped. It is actually the highest form of encryption security that you can get for SMIME encryption for your messages. But it will have an effect of increasing the size of the messages. Negligibly, but of course, if security is paramount for you, the size increase will be meaningless for you. You can configure all of the SMIME settings using the set SMIME config commandlet. You do have to have the org management role, though. We don't have a set of lower RBAC privileges that allows you to do that right now. So you do have to sort of be Superman on the system to be able to do that. In terms of customizing SMIME, some of the things that you can do, for example, you can allow users the choice of signing the message, so you don't have to force them to do that. You can give it to them as an option. Anytime we're doing anything with signing or certificates, we always want to go and check the certificate revocation list, but we don't want that to take too long, so you can also configure the timeout for that, and you can also specify the type of encryption. So, for example, looking at the first example, you can allow the users the choice of signing certificate. We've set that to true. We changed the CRL retrieve timeout to, in this case, 10 seconds. And the encryption algorithm, there's that code I told you about, the 6602, which would be RC2 encryption, and it's :128, so it's 128-bit RC2 encryption. And then the next one is an example where you can see you can use multiple encryptions. So if you've got customers using a variety of platforms that might not support all the different encryption options, you can specify multiple encryption options and allow the user to choose from that as well. All right, SSL offloading. I'm not going to talk too much about that. I know Brian talked a little bit about that. I think Ross also mentioned it briefly. But that is also something that came back in SP1, the ability to do SSL offloading of all those services. Couple things I'll point out is you don't yet see MAPI over HTTP on this list. It's not yet on this list. The other thing I'll point out is the mailbox replication service proxy that has an asterisk next to it. That has an asterisk next to it because that actually runs under EWS. And so you'll actually be doing the SSL offloading for EWS itself, not the MRS proxy service directly. But the good news is the process is much easier. For example, you no longer have to configure that SSL offload registry key. You don't have to go around all your servers and do that. Now there's a white paper that we have. You can go to that URL, and that white paper will walk you through configuring SSL offloading for all the services that you saw on that list individually or simply configuring it for all the services on the server completely. All right. EAC command logging, that's another thing that's also new in Exchange 2013. Came back, we had it in 2010, and now we've got it in 2013. So the way it works is when you're in the Exchange Admin Center, you go ahead and you choose that question mark, and then that show command logging option is available to you. The show command logging option, when that's open, it opens up a dialog that looks like this. And the dialog does have to be open in order for these commands to get logged. And when the dialog is open, whatever you do inside the Exchange Admin Center will get logged up to a maximum of 500 entries. Okay, so you have the last 500 entries of things that you did in there. And it's pretty intuitive. Oh, thank you. Hey, I'll pass that back to the team. That's awesome. So you click X to clear the log if you want to, click the search icon to search through it. You can also select individual items, copy and paste them. You can multi-select. I think we've got an example of that. So here's an individual selection. Here's a multi-selection. You'll see what it'll do here. It'll put them all one by one by one, and I can just copy and paste them. So I mentioned that when you close the command window, it will close and clear the log. The other thing that will happen is if you close the browser, it will clear the log as well. The log is not persisted anywhere. It's held in the session of the browser. If the browser is closed or the logging window is closed, all that stuff is lost. It's not audited or persisted anywhere. All right. MAPI over HTTP, I talked about that as that new communication mechanism and how it modernizes the communication protocols used between Outlook and Exchange. We have a couple different names for it. Its release name is MAPI over HTTP, but you may see it referred to in some code paths as the Exchange HTTP transport protocol. We think we've got all the instances of that in event logs and error messages, but you still might see a few. And when you see that, that's what we're talking about, MAPI over HTTP. You should not see references to Alchemy, though. That was just an internal code name, and that's not in the code path itself. So obviously what that means is it's a different virtual directory. Outlook is connected to a MAPI virtual directory instead of the RPC virtual directory, and all the communication is HTTPS communication, just like Outlook Anywhere, except it's not RPC communication wrapped inside of HTTP. It's the same exact communication verbs that Outlook and Exchange would use, except it's simply being transmitted in raw HTTPS. Now, there are some prereqs that you need. I don't know if anyone's talked about these. You do need, on the CAS role, if you're deploying MAPI over HTTP, you have to install .NET Framework 4.5.1. If you have a business case where you can't install that, you could choose one of those KBs, depending on if it's 2012 or 2008 R2. The KBs, though, are not public, which means if you really can't install a .NET framework and you have to have the KBs, unfortunately, you have to call support to get them. There's no way around that. They're not public KBs. They're not Exchange KBs either, so Exchange has no power to make them public. They're .NET KBs, and the .NET team owns them and decides whether or not they make them public. Our recommendation, quite frankly, would be install .NET 4.5.1, and that covers it. And you don't have to worry about the call to PSS. For publishing to the internet, that depends on what you're using. If you're using TMG, that's simple. Just update your Outlook Anywhere publishing rule to include the MAPI virtual directory. If you're using ARR, that works out of the box. There's nothing you need to do. If you're using UAG, that actually does not work with MAPI over HTTP now, so there's nothing you can do to get that working. And if you're doing WAP, that's simply just create a new application and publish that, and that should also work as well. One other thing to keep in mind, though, is because we've got this new MAPI virtual directory, this doesn't want to work too well, there is a caveat around it. The recover server disaster recovery switch that we have for Exchange setup, that has not been updated to account for the MAPI virtual directory. So that does not recreate those settings in AD. So if you do have to run recover server on a casserole that has had MAPI over HTTP enabled, you actually need to do the steps yourself manually to do that. And I've listed the four steps that you need to do. The information is still in Active Directory. In fact, you're going to be querying Active Directory, writing down the values, and then creating a new virtual directory that has those values in it. So you will effectively be a manual version of Recover Server yourself. That's what Recover Server does. It gets stuff from AD and puts it in the local config. We don't do that with the MAPI virtual directory, so you'll be the Recover Server action item in that case. All right. Data loss prevention enhancements. Okay, I mentioned the three of them, the DLTP policy tips and Outlook web app, the document fingerprinting, and the document classification rules and PII policies that we introduced for Finland, Poland, and Taiwan. For those three countries, we both get their national IDs. And then for Poland, you can see we also do the identity card and Polish passports as well. If you haven't seen it, this is what DLP policy tips look like in Outlook web app. They look almost identical to what you'd see in the Outlook client. They will display the full policy tip, give you the ability to override if the policy allows for that, give you the ability to report if the policy allows for that, and of course, give you the ability to send or not send depending on the policy settings as well. You're seeing it here in Outlook web app, but it also now is available in Outlook web app for devices as well. So if you've downloaded MOA onto your iPad, for an example, you'll see the policy tips there as well. Document fingerprinting is another fantastic feature. It makes things a lot easier for those of you who are trying to control those sensitive information types in your organization. Basically, what you can do is you import document types. It can be a PDF, it can be a Word document, it could be any Office file format, and that now becomes a sensitive information type that you could choose and build DLP policies based on. So as an example, you could import the IRS tax forms, the 1040 forms, and have DLP understand those as a sensitive content type. So if any of those tax forms are filled out in that format and transmitted through the mail system, DLP fingerprinting can find them and then enforce DLP policies against them as well. If you haven't seen DLP fingerprinting, you can do that both through the EAC, or you can do it in PowerShell. I've got some PowerShell examples I'll show you in a minute. But really, there's just really two commandlet sets that you'll be working with, the data classification commandlet set and the fingerprint commandlet set, so that you can create new fingerprints as well. And again, you can do that both in the shell or EAC. Here, you can see it doing it in EAC. Here's an example of doing it in the shell. Okay, so here we're creating a new document template, or a document fingerprint rather, based on the company's patent template that is done in Microsoft Word. So that's a Word doc that we're importing there using the get content and then the new fingerprint commandlet set. Want to get a little fancier? You can actually take multiple templates and put them all together into one sensitive information type. So as an example, going back to the IRS and the downloadable PDFs that it has, there's a PDF that you can get for the 1040, for the 1040E, for the 1040EZ, for the 1040S, just about every one. So what you would do is you would download them all and then import them one at a time into a set, where all the IRS documents would be in one fingerprint set. And so any IRS documents that got transmitted through your messaging system, this one policy would be able to catch and display policy tips and other things as well. One other thing I'll mention out here is in this particular example at the end where I call new fingerprint and then new data classification, you actually need to call these in the same PowerShell session. We do not persist all of this across multiple sessions. So as you're getting the content and running new fingerprint at the same time, you're going to run new data classification without exiting PowerShell so that you can put this all together at the right time. And we tell you that in the cmdlet help file as well, but I find a few customers have already overlooked that. So just be aware that we don't cross session with these particular cmdlets. All right, some IW improvements. I mentioned that that rich text editor we had in Outlook Web App has been replaced. That was an old legacy rich text editor that Exchange had created a few versions ago, actually. We've replaced it. We now use the same rich text editor that you'll find in SharePoint 2013. So the same experience is now preserved across both SharePoint and Outlook Web App as a result of us doing that. And as I mentioned earlier, the other things is now when you're in the Compose experience, we have these apps for Office that are available to you. So if there's something special that a developer wants to do and they want to do it in the new mail experience, we have that capability for them to be able to do that now. All right. DAGs without cluster admin access points. How many of you are running database availability groups in 2010 today? All right. How many of you are running 2013 DAGs? All right. Has anybody created a DAG without a cluster admin access point? Anybody? One person over here, two. All right, three. Okay. So we've got a few things to say about this. I'm only going to say a couple things because there is a whole high availability session that I want you all to go to where we'll talk about it in depth. But this is a new feature. Windows Server 2012 R2 allows you to create a failover cluster without a cluster admin access point. Now, some folks have been confused about what a cluster admin access point means. Per the Windows failover clustering team themselves, they define the cluster admin access point as literally the cluster network name. Okay, so what we're talking about when we say no cluster network name is actually more than that. So in the case of a DAG without a cluster admin access point, we're talking about things like no IP address resource, no network name resource, no cluster name object in Active Directory, no DNS registration for the cluster, and no failover cluster management tool as well. Okay, so that's a big change, but it's kind of a simple change. It's also optional. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. It's just a new option that we've given you so that you don't have to deploy an IP address or multiple IP addresses to your DAG when it's extended across multiple NAPI networks. So you've heard of a DAG with five nines. This is a DAG with five no's. Okay? Sorry, I just made that up on the spot. It didn't land the way I'd hoped. All right. So you can do this in the shell, or you can do this in EAC. And to make it particularly confusing for you, the syntax that you use is completely different in the two tools. So here's the syntax that you'll use in the shell. Here, for the database availability group IP addresses, we're passing a specifically formatted parameter, specifically that system.net.ip address ::none. Okay, that is the syntax where you tell the DAG as you're creating it that this DAG is not going to have an IP address, and as a result, it's not going to have a cluster admin access point. What we're doing behind the scenes is we're calling the new cluster command as we've always done in Exchange, except we're leveraging a new parameter in R2 called administrative access point and the ability to configure that parameter with a value of none. There's two other values per that parameter. One is Active Directory and DNS. The other is DNS only. And the third one that we're using is none. The one that's DNS only is what you would call an Active Directory detached cluster. That is not what we're doing here. I've seen some folks say in their blogs and stuff that that's what we're doing. That's not what we're doing. We are not creating an AD detached cluster because that's a specific feature of the Windows cluster team. We are creating a cluster without an admin access point. So our administrative access point parameter gets set to none. Now, on top of that, we recently found a bug in this new feature. And that bug is it does not work in disjointed namespaces. So if you have a disjointed namespace, you're going to get a very confusing error when you try to create a database availability group at the point where you try to add the first server to, to the group where we try to invoke and start using the witness server and so forth. We are fixing that in CU5. If you're not in a disjoint namespace, you'll have no problems. If you are in a disjoint namespace, just be aware of this. You won't be able to use a DAG without a cap at this point. If you're curious as to what that looks like, here's what it looks like when you do a get database availability group in the shell here. I don't know if they installed Zoomit on this. No, they didn't. And there's no way to zoom on here. So let me highlight that for you. So what you can see here is this 255.255.255.255 address. It's not a real address. It's a pseudo address because that parameter requires a property. Okay, we have to have a value in there. It can't be blank. And in fact, if we set it to blank or what would be considered 0.0.0.0, that would actually configure it for DHCP, which is not what we want to do here. So we have this pseudo IP that we stuff in here, this 255.255.255.255. And it's important because when you're creating a DAG in EAC, and you get to the point where you're assigning it an IP address, there's no option in EAC to choose none. So that is where you actually have to put in the 255.255, et cetera, address. And at that point, that was how we create a DAG without a cap in EAC. Once you have a DAG without a cap, you will not be able to manage the cluster using the Windows Failover Cluster Manager tool. Okay? It doesn't have an admin access point, so there's nothing for you to manage. I mean, yes, there's a cluster there, but nothing with a direct admin access point to it. So instead of managing a cluster, you'll be managing individual nodes, kind of like this. So as an example, when I run get cluster or when I run the get cluster resource commandlets, I'm not running it against my cluster or my DAG name. I'm running it against the individual server names. And in particular, when I enumerate all the resources that are available, you notice you only see the one resource, the file share witness resource. You don't see an IP address resource. You don't see a network name resource because there is none. There's no admin access point for this DAG. It's very unique. One other thing I'll point out is I've given you a shortcut URL to all the PowerShell commandlets for Windows Failover Clustering as well. It's helpful for you to understand some of those, particularly if you are used to managing your cluster through a GUI interface and you decide to go ahead and move to a DAG without a cap, and then now you have no GUI interface. So get to know those as well. The other thing I want to point out is they'll have a lot more to say about this in the high availability session that's coming up on Tuesday at 10:45. All right, let's have some miscellaneous fun now. Let's see what we got. Okay, so in the high availability area, again, I want you to go to that session, but there's a couple things I want to talk about that we'll also talk about in that session, but I want to sort of give you a little brief notes on some of them. Some things like loose truncation, for example. How many of you have heard of loose truncation? Oh, just a few of you. Okay, well, so the short way to think about it is that log truncation just got a little bit more complicated potentially in Exchange 2013 because now we have new behaviors that an administrator can configure. So the problem we're trying to solve with loose truncation is basically this. For those of you who are running a DAG, you already know that during normal operations, when you have multiple database copies and say, for instance, one of your passive copies goes down for maintenance or for whatever reason, during normal operations, all of the copies actually keep all of the logs that they need and that other members of the DAG need in case there's some failure and the logs need to be copied from one of those servers. So that's just the normal behavior. A passive copy will keep the logs until they're replayed, and a lag copy will keep the logs until they're inspected. But what will happen is that truncation will not occur if you've got one of the copies that's down, okay? Because we don't know if that copy needs the logs or not, and so we historically wouldn't want to truncate them. So what we have now is a buildup of log files that's happening on all the other healthy copies. And eventually, if you haven't done any good capacity planning, you might run out of disk space on some of those copies. It could be a concern for you. Now, historically, what administrators would do then, if one of those servers was going to be down for a while, to get truncation to kick in, an administrator would have to go in and remove that database copy. Not necessarily remove the physical files from disk, but basically remove the logical copy so that it wasn't part of the copy set, and then truncation could occur amongst the rest of the survivors. Well, now you don't have to worry about that. With loose truncation, which is disabled by default, by the way, you actually have to go in the registry on all the mailbox servers in your DAG to enable it. But with loose truncation, What happens is you have the ability for the copies to keep track of their available disk space. And if they get below a certain threshold on available disk space, and by default that threshold is 200 gigabytes, but you can configure that as an optional extra registry value. If they fall below a certain threshold of disk space, that will trigger a loose truncation event. In other words, they'll start truncating and flushing all of their logs and cleaning up their file system so that they can prevent themselves from running out of disk space. Now, I will tell you, I have greatly oversimplified that explanation. It's actually a bit more complicated because we've got specific logic in there that forces the copies to retain a minimum set of logs plus extra logs beyond what is required for them to be mounted. So it's not exactly going to be truncating every single log. It can be quite complicated, particularly since you have the ability to control the number of copies that are protected from loose truncation events, the threshold, and the amount of logs that you want to keep, and so forth. So again, check out that high availability session where we're going to go deep into it. Some other things we've done in HA is this cluster database hang detection. So this is something that we saw in Office 365 simply because of the scale at which we're operating. So during normal operations, when clusters need to do things, they talk to each other. And one of the tasks that they do is they maintain a common view of cluster state and cluster resources inside this cluster database, also sometimes known as the cluster registry. And this database is automatically replicated between all the members of the DAG so that they can all agree on a common view. So when one of the nodes has to make an update to that database, it calls into a cluster component called the Global Update Manager, and it puts a lock on the database so that it can write the updates. And then after it locks the database and writes the updates, it sends out a multicast reply to all the other nodes to say, hey, go look at this database write and acknowledge that you received it and that you agree with it so that we can all agree on what's happening in this cluster. Well, every once in a while, and this is almost always due to some form of storage stack issue, every once in a while, the node with the lock will get stuck because one of those replies won't come back in. Okay, and when that happens, no updates are happening to the cluster database anymore. It basically freezes the cluster from those nodes' perspective. And from a DAG perspective, that is very bad because we store database and store properties and content indexing and a whole bunch of other information inside that cluster database. So if that gets locked and stuck, the DAG starts having serious problems. So what's happened is we went to the Windows team and the Windows Failover Cluster team put in a design change request for us, and they introduced two new cluster control codes. And those control codes, one of them is there to tell us which node has the GUM lock, and the other one is there to tell us which nodes are stuck, if any. It's usually one or more than one. And knowing that, now that we are armed with that information, that means something like managed availability or the Exchange High Availability platform can recognize and receive one of these control codes. And when it sees this state, we now have the ability to auto-recover automatically by bug checking the server and rebooting it. That always unsticks it. So historically, we'd have to send an admin out to push the power button. Now we don't have to. Why am I bringing this up? I bring it up because we've actually had this in 2013 for a while, but it hasn't applied to all the operating systems that you can install Exchange on. It only recently became available for Windows Server 2012. We had it available in 2008 R2. That's where that first DCR was introduced. Then it made its way into 2012 R2. And we sort of skipped over 2012, and now we've got it back fixed into 2012. And so what that means is we are able to monitor for this cluster hang, and when we detect it, we're able to auto-recover from it by rebooting the box to solve the problem. And now we can do that on all DAGs because now it's available on all platforms. This is a public hotfix, so you can just go and download it and install it on your Windows 2012 servers. Don't need it on 2008 R2, don't need it on 2012 R2, but you do need it on 2012 RTM. Another thing that I've noticed some customers are struggling with this parameter that we have called database copy auto-activate policy. This database copy auto-activate policy is one of basically three ways that you can block a database from automatic activation by the system. So some customers like to do this because they like to designate specific databases or specific servers as DR servers. And as you know, HA is automatic, DR is manual. So by saying these are DR servers, the admin wants control and the admin wants to do the manual activation. But typically what happens is the organization has a primary production site and a DR site, and no one's operating in the DR site. So all the servers are blocked for activation in that DR site. Nothing is unblocked. What happens though, and this is in part because we did not document this clearly, it's very clear that obviously we're blocking automatic activation, but what's not clear is that when you set this parameter to a value of blocked, we also block all server requests to that server as well. It's not just automatic activation of a database, but all server requests as well. So what that means is if you have a DR site, even if you manually activate the database, if you've set this policy to blocked on all your servers, after you've activated that database, no one can get to it. Okay, again, because all of the server calls are blocked when this policy is set. So as long as you don't set this policy to blocked on all of your DR servers, or as long as you remember to unblock it on at least one when you're operating on those DR servers, you won't run into this problem. But if you forget and you leave things as blocked, even if you take the steps and manually act the database, people aren't going to be able to log into it because server calls to that server will be blocked until you unblock that. So that's what people don't understand, is that this also affects manually affected databases as well, not just automatically activated databases. All right, we did some work around auto reseed. There's a whole bunch of bugs and other improvements that we've done. Not really any of those are in public KBs or anything worth talking about. It's mostly internal code cleanup. But there are a couple extra things that we've done. We've added some new misconfiguration events. So if you don't have your volume mount points correctly configured, if you don't have the expected number of database directories correctly configured, auto reseed will now capture this and it will event in the event log and tell you that things are misconfigured. So auto reseed is easy to configure if you follow the instructions, but it's also very easy to go awry with it if you've got too many databases or if you get interrupted or whatever. So if you do end up with a misconfiguration, auto reseed has been improved to kind of pick up on some of that stuff as well. All right, managed availability. Again, I want to promote the session. You definitely want to go see the managed availability breakouts, and you definitely want to go and see the experts unplug session, because we're going to have a lot to say about that there. But I did want to mention one cool thing that we've done there is we now give you the ability to control the free disk space threshold we use for the disk space monitor for managed availability. So if you don't configure a registry entry, by default, that responder will kick in if you go below 200 gigabytes of free disk space on any volume containing a database. Okay, you can control that threshold, though. You can go in and create that space monitor, low space threshold in MB value, and you can set it to whatever you want, 300, 400, 100, and control the threshold that MA will use for alerting you about that. All right, let's talk a little bit about search. Again, I want to promote the session. Definitely go see the search PMs. They'll have a lot to say. But I've got a few notes to give you as well. So search has changed a little bit in 2013, not just the change going from, say, for instance, Microsoft Search and Exchange 2010 to Exchange Search or Search Foundation, or what used to be called FAST in Exchange 2013. We've also changed the requirements around the Office Filter Pack as well. You may have noticed in Service Pack 1 setup, we don't warn you if the Office Filter Pack is not installed anymore. Okay? It's no longer a hard prereq for Exchange 2013. The reason for that is the Search Foundation, the built-in search that comes with Exchange, has all of the same native search filters built into it. So Office Filter Pack really just adds two search filters for transport searching, one for OneNote and one for publisher files. If you don't have a need for those, for having a search of those files while in transport, then you simply don't need the Office Filter Pack. If you do install the Office Filter Pack, the filters that it has in common with Search Foundation, those will simply get overridden with the Search Foundation filters, and everything will be fine there. The other thing that we've done is in SP1, we now give you the ability to do third-party and custom iFilters as well. We didn't have that in RTM, but it is now back in SP1. Now, typically, the most common third-party filter you would go get historically might be for a PDF or maybe even for a zip file. Both of those are already included natively in 2013 with Search Foundation. So you don't have to go to Adobe or you don't have to go somewhere else to get them. They're built in into the box for you now. The other thing that you can do is if you are interested in what search formats we can use, you can just simply use the Get Search Format commandlet, and that will give you a list of all the supported formats, whether they're enabled or not. Now, all the formats that we ship with 2013 are enabled by default out of the box, so you don't have to worry about having to turn stuff on. But if for whatever reason you didn't want something indexed, you could turn a specific format off. And you would use the set search document format commandlet to do that. One thing I'll mention about some of the image file formats like JPEG and GIF, and I think, and this is something that I'm still checking on, I think we were supposed to also ship with a TIFF format, but TIFF is not one that I found on my own server, so I did not include it in this, and we're looking to see what happened there. But the same thing would apply to TIFF if we included it. So JPEG and GIF and TIFF, we're not doing any fancy OCR or anything like that with these images. All we're doing is looking at the metadata on the image files themselves, and that is what is getting indexed by Microsoft Search. So if there is nothing, then these items effectively get skipped by content indexing, and they end up getting marked as partially processed as a result of that. So keep that in mind. That is the normal behavior. If you're seeing things getting processed partially, and it turns out that they're image files, this is normal expected behavior. Doesn't mean that your content index is now out of date or anything like that. All right, if you do get a new iFilter, you can use the search document format commandlet, the new search document format commandlet, rather, to install that format. I've got an example there. We're installing a file extension of SCT that has a MIME type of text/scriptlet. And then one thing you need to do is you do need to restart the search service after creating a new search format. So that's why that restart service for that host controller service, which actually is the name of the primary search service, that needs to be restarted as well. The other thing I'll point out is I've given that search document format a name of SCT. The name itself actually does not need to be unique. So you could use that same name for multiple search formats and basically create a new category of document types that are being searched as a result of all having the same name field. And then, of course, the remove search document format parameter can be used to remove custom formats. It cannot be used to remove any of the built-in formats, but it can be used to remove any of the custom formats that you create with new search document format. A couple other things about Search. Search Foundation, like some of the other processes that we have in Exchange, it uses a worker process model. And so what that means is that there's the parent process, that host controller service, and then there's some worker processes, in this case, noderunner.exe. And there's four worker processes, each corresponding to a node or a type of activity that Search Foundation does. And in fact, all of them are called NodeRunner.exe. So if you pull up Task Manager, you'll see NodeRunner.exe listed four times. So one is for the admin node, the administrative interface. One is for content, that's incoming documents. One is for indexing, the processing and indexing of documents. And then one is for the query interface. The challenge is, when you're looking at Task Manager and you see one of these processes maybe running away with the CPU or using a lot of memory, you might be wondering, which process is it? How do I figure that out? Well, the admin and the content and the index and the query, they all have unique node names in the actual command line that's executed to run these processes. So what you need to do is you need to pull up Task Manager, and then you can find the node runners. And then if you expand the description view, You can see down here, the command line view, rather. If you add that and you stretch it all the way along, you'll start to see things like admin node 1, content node 1, index node 1, and then for query, the interaction management node is what that's called. And this will be able to tell you at a glance which one of those nodes is using the CPU or using the memory or running away with resources and so forth. And you'll know, for instance, obviously, if it's the index node, a bunch of content must have been added and the indexer is just doing its thing and trying to index stuff. Or maybe something happened with the index and now you're rebuilding the index and you'd expect the index node to be using quite a bit more resources. Or maybe you might see the query node, or what again is called the interaction management node. If that is starting to run away with resources, that would be an indication that users are hitting search very hard right now and you might want to investigate what's going on there and so forth. All right, some odds and ends. Mailbox delivery throttling. This is another one of those areas where we're trying to give you control over the types of logging that we're doing on the system. As you may have discovered by now, in Exchange 2013, we do a considerable amount of logging in the file system. And in fact, that is one of the reasons our minimum system requirements went up from the disk perspective from 1.3 gigabytes in Exchange 2010 to 30 gigabytes in Exchange 2013 because of all the logging that's going on. Now, in some cases, we give you control over logging. In some cases, we don't. In other words, there's some processes that logging is on. It's non-configurable, and it can't be disabled. Calendar logging areas is a good example of that. But in the case of the mailbox delivery throttling, any time that we're doing throttling of delivery on the mailbox, that's going to go into this log, and you now have the ability to control the age of the log, the size of the log, the path of the log, and so forth. So this is one area where we're trying to give you control over the logs. You should expect us to do similar things with other components that are logging as well. But I will say we're still going to have the system always be logging the amount of information we think we need it to have from a performance standpoint, from a diagnostic standpoint, from a workload management standpoint, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Exchange Deployment Assistant. How many of you have heard of this tool? All right. This is a great tool. I wanted to mention that obviously with the updates that we've done for Exchange 2013 SP1, there's going to be updates coming for this tool. Now, they're not there yet, but I did talk to the tool owners, and they did give me permission to disclose to you what is coming. So some things that are coming, obviously, the multi-forest hybrid exchange scenario, that will be coming for Exchange 2010, because we've got one deployment assistant for both 2010 and 2013. We'll also be introducing the Edge server for 2013 SP1 into all of the relevant scenarios as well. And then we're going to be integrating a new tool called the Hybrid Edition Product Key Tool. I'm going to demo that for you in a little bit. And that integration will make things easier for hybrid customers from a deployment perspective as well. If you haven't used the tool, you can go to that URL. It's a website. Basically, you just answer a couple questions about your existing environment, and then it gives you step-by-step instructions for deploying Exchange in the configuration that you wanted. And that could be, Exchange 2013 on-premises. It could be 2013 on-prem plus some hybrid mailbox users, or we'll also link you over directly to Office 365 if you're doing a completely cloud-only installation as well. This is the tool that we would recommend generally all customers use for their deployment, unless you're just so large, you're working with MCS in a large type of engagement. But if you want to do this stuff yourself, this is the tool that customers all over the world are using today to do their Exchange deployments. All right. Now, speaking of that hybrid key tool, there is a new process that we have. So if you're an Exchange on-premises customer, and you've just bought Office 365 and you want to go into hybrid mode, historically what you would do is you would either call Office 365 support or you would open a support ticket through the Office 365 admin support portal and you would request a hybrid key. This would go ahead and generate a ticket, and maybe a few hours later or maybe the next day someone in support would go ahead and email you the key. Now, you can go and self-serve yourself. You don't have to make that support call. You can get your key right away by going to that URL at aka.ms/hybrid key. When you do that, what will happen is you will go to this screen, And when you're on the screen here, there's not too many choices here. It's really either going to be cancel or get key. So what you'll do is you'll click get key to start. And it's going to verify your tenant. So it already knows the tenant I'm at, because when I go to that URL I had up earlier, I'm logging into the Office 365 portal as my tenant. So it's going to verify that I'm eligible to receive a free key. You have to be a purchase subscriber in order to get it. We don't give it out for trial users. And then once it verifies that I'm eligible, it's going to ask me for what environment, for 2013 or 2010. So you can see we can do both environments here, and it's telling us what the admin display version. So if you're actually not sure what you're running, run Get Exchange Server, and that will tell you what version of Exchange you have. In my case, I'm running Exchange 2013, so I'm just going to click Next. And then once again, it's going to go through a quick verification and verify that I'm eligible for a key, and then boom, it's going to give me the key. Now, the screenshots were actually from my actual tenant. In a live environment, and so I've redacted the key. So I'm not going to share my hybrid key with you. But you can do this yourself with your own tenant. Actually, even if you're not going into hybrid mode, if you want to generate the key, go ahead. It's not going to harm anything. It's not going to change anything with your tenant either. It's just generating a key that you can use if you decide to go into hybrid mode. So this is redacted, and it's redacted in such a way that when you get the slides in the download format, you won't be able to hack it and figure it out. So don't even waste your time. All right. Okay, some PowerShell quickies. I'm not going to go through all of these in depth, but I wanted to include them because these are things that I just work with directly with customers on. So as an example, customer wanted to find out what UM gateway servers they had that were all enabled for outbound calls, and they wanted to see the hunk groups associated with them. So we've got what's actually a two-liner. So the first one, we're just setting the alias for get UM IP gateway. And then the next one, we're taking the gateways and we're finding which ones are enabled for outbound calling and what hunk group they're in. If you want to find the ones that are disabled, just change true to false there, and that'll flip the bit for you. What else we got here? Commandlet and size values. Any commandlets that we have that accepts any kind of a size value, you actually can put that size value in just about any format that you wanted. It could be kilobytes, could be megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, any format that you want. So as an example, set mailbox, I could give Brian Day, who was up on stage before me, I can give him a 200 megabyte mailbox, basically. I'm not going to let him send mail after his mailbox is over 200 megabytes. But his boss, I'm going to give him a 200 gigabyte send and receive quota, or in this case, a send quota. And then I couldn't help it for Ross. I gave Ross a 200 terabyte limit just because I think he deserves it. He kicks ass, so 200 terabytes. All right. And then the last thing is exporting messages from transport queues. The process has changed slightly. There's actually this filter or script that you need to do that you need to use when you're exporting messages from the queue. It's called assemble message. So I've given you a couple examples here. One, we're looking for a specific message with a specific message ID. This is all one line that's wrapped. So we're using export message. We're giving it the identity of the server, the name of the queue, the name of the message ID, and then we're typing that out to assemble message, and then assemble message will find that message in the queue and create a .eml file for me in that destination. That's getting one specific message. If I just want to dump all the queue, grab all the messages, I would use the next commandlet, and this is simply enumerating the queue, grabbing each object, and then for each object, it's creating an email message based on their internet message ID. So each message will be a unique EML file inside the file system. Pretty quick and simple, but I thought it's powerful stuff worth sharing. All right, some resources for you. MAPI over HTTP, there are some great sessions that I suggest that you attend if you're interested. And there's also some previously published sessions that we have out there as well on Channel 9. So if you're interested in seeing some of that stuff, I would strongly recommend going and checking that out at your convenience as well. And then I would strongly recommend all of you get connected. You know, I'm sure you've heard plenty of times this week already that social is a big thing for us. And what that means is not just inside of our products, but also within the community as well. We would love for you to join the community, join third-party communities, participate in forums, hang out with MVPs, share your expertise, get questions answered, and so forth. You'll find not just your peers in a lot of these forums, but you'll also find a lot of Microsoft folks in there as well. So lots of great, rich places to get knowledge. Some other places that are also equally good as well. Some of those other forums, some downloads. That 2013 poster is actually the RTM one. It's a little out of date because hopefully all of you have looked in your blue bags and you saw the Service Pack 1 version of the Exchange poster that, by the way, only you have right now. We have not posted that to the download center. So the only way to get that poster, particularly a hard copy, was to come to this event and get one of those blue bags. And then there's other add-ons like DLP policy templates. There's policy templates that add additional functionality to DLP that you can get from Microsoft and DLP partners around the world. There's the Office Visio stencils that have been updated for all of the shapes, not just in Exchange, but also across SharePoint and Link and the rest of Office, and of course some of the other ancillary downloads as well. I also want to highlight the solutions using Office servers in the cloud as well. This is a another team in my group. We call them the Content Solutions and the Moda team. They're the ones who are creating content that does things like give you a cross-product solution. So Exchange and Link, or Exchange and SharePoint, or Exchange Link and SharePoint, or SharePoint on Azure. They just did a great content solution on using Azure for disaster recovery of SharePoint. So those kinds of things. And in fact, if you are interested, and later on today at 6 p.m. in room 8AB, we are having a side meeting with the Solution Advisory Board that runs that team. Okay, so if you want to meet them and talk to them about solution content, or if you have ideas for solution content, head there and join the call. We'd love to have you participate with that. All right. So with that, there goes the bird. All right, if you like that, it's actually even funnier backwards as it unbirds, but all right, enough fooling around. Okay, so questions, I will be in the expo hall afterwards. We do have about 9 minutes, so I am happy to take some questions, but before I get into that, I do wanna remind you to fill out your evals. We want your feedback, and you can win some pretty cool prizes as well. And now I'm happy to take any questions. Or, thank you.